Welcome to Policy in a Pint. Welcome to the Amsterdam. Thanks again to the folks at the Amsterdam here for hosting us and making us feel welcome for another Policy in a Pint. And my gosh. So we're celebrating 10 years of The Current this week, and we have, thank you. We've been, thank you. And it's kind of mind-boggling and amazing and overwhelming. And this is the longest time I've ever done anything in a row, one gig in a row. And to think that I could do the most wonderful job in the world and have it, you know, do it for 10 years is humbling and amazing. And that's just the fact that this station is here and able to do what it is, what it does for this community, is a testament to the community itself. And we are humbled every day by the support that we receive from you and from Minnesota in general. And as for Policy in a Pint in particular, we've been doing Policy in a Pint. I was trying to remember, I thought, did we start it like a year in? Has it been like, is it always a year, you know, one digit lower than the anniversary of the station? I went back and looked. The first one was actually in August of 2005. So it goes back to the first year that we were on the air. And we didn't know where this program was going to go and whether or not it was going to be a success. I was so honored to be asked to be the host of it. And the thing to keep in mind about this show is that it would not have existed at all without the Citizens League approaching us and asking us to do it. So I just want to give the Citizens League their props. Please, yeah. Sean Kershaw from the Citizens League is a wonderful human being, and we're so pleased that Sean would be our partner for so many years in this. He really means it, actually, I think. The Citizens League is a wonderful organization. If you're not familiar with it, check out their website and see what they're all about. And it's just about getting people involved in our community and getting involved in issues and realizing that that's what citizenship is all about, and it's not some boring thing. You know, many of us were made to think that citizenship and civics and all these words were just these dreadful concepts, you know, and we were scarred by our middle school exposure to those words. But, you know, the thing that's been heartening to me is that I have seen that that is not the way that Minnesota is, and it's not the way that the Twin Cities is. We are so proud to be involved and to be dialed in and to care and to think intelligently and carefully about things that matter to us and about matters of policy, for heaven's sake. And so, like I said, I'm so glad that this program is here, and thank you so much for coming tonight. To have a sold-out crowd here for this is really a special treat on our 10th anniversary tonight. Our program tonight, oh, by the way, I should say that this is the second year that we've had corporate support from Target Corporation, so that's a huge deal for us to have a major sponsor on board for Policy in a Pint, so we thank Target for being behind us as well. Tonight's program, Buses, Bikes, and Beyond, Transportation in Minnesota in the 21st Century. So, sprawling topic again. What did we do? We chose a topic that's way too sprawling. What I'm going to do here tonight really is, again, ask just like probably knuckleheadedly broad questions, and I trust, because this is always the way that Policy in a Pint works, you guys will ask the really incisive questions and the really specific ones, because I'm not like abdicating my responsibility. That's just how it works, because that's the kind of audiences that we get here. And so, you know, that's another wonderful aspect of this program. We know that we face challenges and changes. Our demographics in Minnesota are changing. Baby boomers retiring. There's going to be a massive wave of retirement. Millennials, the generation that is going to define the decisions that we make in the next 15 and 30 years. There will be a boom in new jobs in the next 15 years. Where will we live? Will we live in cities? Will we live in the suburbs? What is going to be the migration patterns from the country to the city? How do millennials want to get around? What resources do the elderly need that perhaps we haven't thought about thoughtfully before? Meanwhile, we all know that our roads and our bridges are very old, all in need of care. How do we plan smartly for the future? And, you know, what modes of thinking are outmoded? What simply will not work in the future? How do we know in planning what is going to work? How do we figure this stuff out? It all comes down to money, too. This is going to be the trick here tonight, is to make sure that we recognize the realities of money and funding and don't get too pie in the sky, but at the same time, don't get bogged down in a conversation about money. So that's my job, no pressure. Charlie Zelli has been Minnesota's commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Transportation since January 2013. MnDOT is the Minnesota state agency charged with managing and maintaining the state's multimodal transportation system. In 2012, he served on the governor's Transportation Finance Advisory Committee, which made recommendations on state transportation funding to the governor in December. Rita Albrecht is mayor of Bemidji. Right on, Rita, the rock star mayor. She was elected mayor in 2012 after serving 2 years on the city council, re-elected last year. Rita has professional experience in a variety of public sector positions, including as assistant planner and community development director for the city of Bemidji. Also development specialist for Headwaters Regional Development Commission, planner and economic development specialist for the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe as well. And John Doan, here to my immediate left, is Hennepin's County Director for Community Works. He leads the Department of Planners and Engineers and Economic Development Professionals with the annual operational budget of $24 million, capital budget of $60 million. From 2011 to 2013, he served as member of the Met Council, which is the Twin Cities Metropolitan Planning Organization, its largest transit operator. And his career includes the MinPass program director for the Minnesota Department of Transportation, where he led MnDOT's feasibility planning and contracting and financing and public involvement efforts to implement MinPass. So we'll talk about how this show works and the format and all that very briefly, but please can you just thank our guests for coming here tonight, taking their time out to be with us this evening. This is really very simple. I'll chat with these guys for a few minutes and then go out and take your questions from the audience. Please get involved on Twitter as well. We want to keep the conversation going all night long. I suck at Twitter, and I really still haven't gotten up to speed with it, but my producer is going to send me all the good tweets. And if you want to ask a question on Twitter, if you'd rather go that way, then it's hashtag policypint is where to follow along, and ideally where the conversation will continue after the program is over tonight as well. So again, broad knucklehead questions is where I'm going to begin. Are people happy with transportation? Not. Nobody is, right? I mean, pretty much everybody, right? No. You know,
is that the question?
Everybody, well, here's I'll flesh out what I mean exactly. We'll talk about money, we'll get to it, obviously, but the transportation conversation is itself, in essence, how do I get where I need to go? And you probably never see people really saying, everything's fine, I'm happy to be in gridlock for an hour a day, or I'm happy with the fact that, I mean, everybody either wishes there were more, there were more trains or more buses, or damn it, why did I lose 6 feet of my road to a bike lane? So, you know, do we have a general sense of what public opinion is on transportation? I'll ask about your opinions in a moment. But as far as, like, you know, what did people used to want as far as, you know, how to get from here to there? Did it used to be all about roads? And what do they want now? And what do we see people wanting in the future? Yeah, broad question. I got, like, glass eyes looking at me like, are you kidding me? How am I supposed to tackle this? But I bet Charlie can start it off.
I have the answer.
Okay.
First off, great to be here. I love being here with my friends, Rita and John. And I'm not been asked to say this, but I am a big fan of The Current. I'm a member, and I'm an even bigger fan of the Citizens League. And Sean, you're doing a great group. I am a member of that as well. And Sean, talk to me about doing these pint and beer and buses. And yeah. It wasn't buses, just right. Beer. And I thought we were just sitting around a table with his friends, so I guess we are.
Surprise. There's a lot of people here. Yeah.
You know, when I was becoming a commissioner, I was told by some elected officials, are you sure you want to do this? Because, MnDOT, you will be pissing people off on a daily basis. And but, you know, the reality is we do a lot of surveys, and we find everybody in Minnesota has a different story. They use transportation differently each time. Yes, congestion is frustrating, and, you know, potholes are frustrating. I had the mayor of Bloomington come by my house with a large Christmas present. He dropped it off with my wife, really heavy, and I came home and I thought, gosh, Gene Winstead, he is such a nice guy. And it was the bent rim of his Cadillac wheel. And it came with a really nice letter that described how he wanted to be supportive because he now had a personal stake in how we might be improving the system. I think everybody has a story of frustration, but everybody has a story of things that they absolutely count on, including bike trails and transit connections and that we did a lot of surveys and we collected stories at the state fair about everybody's individual trip. And you know what we found is that it's not the transportation itself. It's all the kind of the access to their cabin, getting to work. It's what transportation does. If people care about their health, they care about their economy, they care about their job, they care about getting to school, that's the benefit. That's the part that I think we all really like about what transportation does.
So, we always used to want roads and more roads and more roads and more roads, and now it seems that we want something more in the future. But we have to still remember that the roads are the fundamental way we're going to be getting around, and we have to fix them first, right? Before we can even start to talk about all these other things that we may want as far as bikes and trains and buses and et cetera, et cetera.
So I don't know if anybody's tried to get from Hanoi to Ho Chi Minh City. Anybody been to Vietnam? Okay, well, I see a few hands out there. So I was born in Vietnam and left when I was a wee tot, when I was about 4. And about 5 years ago, I had the chance to go back for the first time. And the best way to get from Hanoi, which is the capital, to Saigon, which is the commercial center of Vietnam, the best way is by plane. It's not by rail, it's not by car. If you wanted to go by bus, it's going to be at least a day trip. And so I think as we talk about transportation and what we have here, we should put it in context of what the rest of the world has, and I'll add to that in a second. We're not doing too badly relative to other states. We're not doing as well as we should be relative to our own expectations. So I think that's important to recognize. But I'll go back to the Vietnam story right now to say that what's happening there, though, is because it's developing much faster than we are. We're a much more mature and built-out economy and infrastructure system. In Vietnam, they don't actually have a landline telecom system. They skipped over fiber. Fiber is not really where it's at for them. They went straight to wireless. Most people there don't have a landline telephone. They went straight to cellular technology. And that's what they're doing now with their roadway infrastructure. They've just said, you know, we're going to be growing. We look to the future. And I'm going to say the dirty T word here. What they're doing is they're building out a system of toll roads. But that's the way they're seeing how they can manage their congestion in the future. That's how they're going to manage paying for the system, because someone needs to pay for it. And it's a dirty word, but the buck's got to stop somewhere. And somehow these systems have to be paid for. Now we as a society need to choose how we prioritize that, what we value, and who pays for it.
Yeah, Rita.
Thanks, and I want to say thank you for inviting me too, and a lot of people talk about what the 6 degrees of separation, how you know someone, and Charlie and I was elected mayor, first of all, I was sworn in 2013, and We were on the same ticket at the Bike Minnesota Day at the Hill back in 2013, so this is the second time I've been on the agenda with Charlie, and turns out that John's wife is from, guess where? Bemidji. Yeah. So we have a lot of things in common already. I'll just say that I come from a little bit different place in the room because I'm not worrying about the state as Charlie is, or worrying about a whole county, Hennepin County, as John is, but I'm worrying about a community of Bemidji, which is, just to give you a little brief snapshot of our community, is we have about just under 15,000 people in our political boundaries right now, but within a 40 to 50 mile radius, there's 100,000 people, which makes us a pretty busy regional center, and a lot of traffic, and our population has a big bounce during the day when people come into town to work. And so we have a lot of challenges with our streets as far as a city government being able to pay for them, and how are we going to pay for that, because there's not a lot of assistance from the state for that, and it falls on taxpayers, and that's a challenge. But we've had a real renaissance in our community, partly because our city council has made the decision to invest in trails. And so we have recognized, because there's been community outpouring and support for them, that we need to make sure we have trails in our transportation system. So we started doing that when we got a half-cent sales tax to improve our parks and trails, and all of a sudden we have some money to spend, right? But we didn't just spend it out. What we did was we leveraged that money by getting grants from the federal government, state of Minnesota, MnDOT, DNR, partnerships. And so we've really been able to build out a trail system in our community that is really world-class and for a community our size, and quite substantial with a very small investment. I was just figuring out how many state and federal dollars did we get to build out that trail system. And it turns out we leveraged several million dollars, and we had about less than a 20% contribution to that. So that's the way that local communities like mine can make an investment in parks. And there's in trails, and there's other ways too, but that was one of the main things that we've done.
I love that you're already talking about
funding. Yeah, the dirty word, funding.
Well, and that's actually what I'm going to segue into, because we've got to establish a sort of general base knowledge about how, you know, our tax revenues pay for things, if it's even possible. I don't know if there's a way to sort of break it down or if it's that simple, but can we at least get what pays for roads and bridges? What part of the, is there there's a dedicated tax for that, right?
The state highway system is funded entirely through user fees, a gas tax, a motor vehicle sales tax, and a registration tax, and some federal money. So that goes through formulas. Roughly 40% of the gas tax, registration fees, and motor vehicle sales tax that we all pay goes to counties, some to Hennepin, and to municipalities, some to Bemidji, and helps to pay only a small part of the transportation costs that these kind of local governments have to pay for those roads. So there's local roads, county roads, and then the state roads. And a lot of that is through what we call them user fees, but it's primarily from gas taxes. And if, you know, spoiler alert, we all know that as price of fuel goes up and down, it doesn't really affect the amount of gas tax, because it's a fixed amount. And as our cars get more and more efficient, I drive an electric car, so, you know, I don't pay much gas tax.
Free rider.
There you go. But you know what? As cars get more fuel efficient, less money's going into the system. So now we're talking
okay.
about that.
And that's going to be an issue. Now, how do we pay for public transportation, like buses?
Well, buses, the transit systems, are paid from a combination of sources again, property taxes, some limited amount of general fund from the state budget, and then also a large share coming from sales tax these days, a 0.25% in the metro area.
And we haven't even gotten to light rail, but go ahead, John.
And I should add, transit actually pays for it at the fare box.
And the fare box.
Not at 100% for sure, but a chunk of it, particularly for the light rail system. I think the last numbers I saw were 35 or so cents on the dollar that it was paying for itself.
Okay, and I don't want to spend too much time, but I think it's
just
general knowledge.
One more thing, and that is that local streets get a contribution from the motor vehicle sales or the gas tax, 16%. And actually, St. Paul's mayor, Mayor Coleman, has put together a group called the 84%, which is the 84% of the local streets that don't get any state funding. And all of that cost goes on to the taxpayers. And so this group of mayors has gotten together, and we've put together some proposals that we would like to see promoted at the legislature to help local governments pay for local streets. And one of those things is called a street improvement district. So I know that Senator Jim Carlson has put that in his part of the transportation bill in the Senate. So I'm looking forward to seeing if that has any legs at the legislature.
Does the public generally understand, in your experience, how things are paid for? Because I feel like you get this kind of, you know what I'm saying? Because, and he's nodding like, are you kidding? Because
I didn't understand it until
So the governor comes out and asks for a certain amount several years ago, and the money comes into the coffers, and then people say, well, where did all that money go? I didn't see it spent on anything. So people generally don't really have an understanding of where their tax money is being spent, and that's a problem.
Well, I think it's also widely misunderstood, and that it is a very expensive system: roads, bridges, buses, light rail, bicycle lanes, and these big projects, these big infrastructure, not only cost a lot to build, but they cost a lot to maintain, to keep them up, to rebuild them, repave them. We in Minnesota like our infrastructure, our system, to be in good shape. And guess what? They don't stay in good shape unless we invest in them. And so I think it is sometimes confused that, you know, you'll see ads where, why is there a new Senate office building when we should fix a road? Well, you know what? Entirely different pot of money. And when you think about the state government, 80% of the assets of government are actually all these roads and bridges. And they're funded through these dedicated funds. It can't go into the general fund. It's a completely separate system.
80% of the assets.
The value, the market value of, you know, you think of buildings and all the things that the government owns. Think about the transportation system.
Yeah.
You know,
the
it's
roads and the
20,000 bridges, we have in Minnesota.
Okay. Now, and again, we can't really get very far without acknowledging that it's a very busy week at the Capitol. A lot of proposals going around, a lot of tension, because there always is when it comes to this, because you know, the governor has basically come out and said, look, get real. We can't pay for this stuff that needs to be done unless there's an awful lot of increased income. Republicans are saying, no frickin' way are we going to allow the kind of tax raising or whatnot that you're talking about, additional levies, fees, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, we go around and around on this, but nevertheless, the governor has said, we need $600 billion or something?
Well, the governor hasn't come out with a specific proposal.
Okay.
There's a Senate proposal, there's a House proposal, but the governor has acknowledged and said, I mean, he's pretty much said, look, we need to solve a $6 billion gap just for the state system over a period of 10 years. And you know, you think about this, a lot of money, it is a lot of money, for us all as individuals, and I always look at my chief of staff, that he's willing to give up a beer a month. Is that what it is? You're willing to give about a, you're not going to give it up. You're willing to pay for it. So it's about, I got it, the price of a beer a month would equal about 10, 15 cents a gallon. You know, so the fact is, you know, we use this system, but what's widely misunderstood is for what we pay, for what we get, it's not that much.
Okay, now I know, though this is just dry as hell, this stuff is boring, and we want to talk about bikes, and we want to talk about positive vision, and, you know, where, how we really want to get around in the future, but I felt like it was important to kind of lay this groundwork of this sort of stuff. Can we sum up the, are there fundamental issues then? We talked about public's perception. Is there fundamental issues then in you guys' minds that we face going into the next 15, 30 years that we have to talk about addressing then? And does it just come down to money? And, you know, who gets to decide why spending the money this way is more sensible than spending it that way. How do we figure such things out?
You know, there's a big puzzle out there, and it's not just roads and bridges, but it's bike lanes, it's transit, it's connections to airports, it's pedestrian space. And the reality is, the decision is up to us as citizens. It's up to all of you. If we want to have the Minnesota of the future that's economically competitive, that is attracting talent from other places that we want to live in as we grow, we want choices of how we get around. And we're in the middle of a transportation revolution. There's Uber and car-to-goes, there's bikes, and all of it kind of connecting together. That's what Minnesota is all about. That's why we're leading the nation, and we got to just kind of keep that kind of momentum and that kind of vision going. It's all about our prosperity and our quality of life.
Now, we hear about millennials an awful lot, and what millennials are going, what they already want in transportation and in their communities is pretty radically different than what baby boomers wanted, the two-car garage and, just fix my congestion and I'm happy. You know, millennials, actually, I was reading something somewhere that by a considerable margin, like a staggering margin, millennials would be willing to do without a car before they'd be willing to do without their phone. And that is really, when you think about it, not surprising when it comes to the phone, but really to do without a car. And that what it says is that they really expect to live in a totally different kind of environment. So is that, and they want public transportation, they want bicycling, they want bike paths, they want walkable cities. So is that going to drive policy? Is that actually going to be able to make change in the future, or are we so stuck in the situation that we live in that it's going to be hard to make change?
Well, I think it's already started. I think that what some people call the metro revolution has started. You know, one of the things that I see is not so much that the millennials are choosing a different path, it's that the millennials and the baby boomers are choosing a different path. I think that baby boomers, what their expectations are in their years of retirement are very similar to the millennials. They want good access to transit. They want to be able to walk to the doctor and to the grocery store. They want to have community, just like we all want to have community. They've lived the life of the three-car garage, and I think a lot of them are choosing other or making other choices in their sunset years.
I think I have to agree with that. I think part of the reason that Bemidji is attractive to young people, and actually our population in Bemidji in our region is growing at about 3% a year. We had a 12% increase in the population in our county over the last census, which is kind of unheard of in the rural areas. A lot of rural farm areas in particular are losing population. The Northeast is losing population. But that Lakes and Pines corridor up through the spine of our state is really gaining population. And we are trying to respond, I think, to the desires of young people, because one might think that our population growth is due to retirement people, a little bit of that, but actually our population demographic is becoming younger, new families. We just passed a school referendum to build a new elementary school because we're, you know, bursting at the seams. So I think they're driving that, and one of the things when we are trying to attract families or new employees or new businesses to our community, we're going to talk about our great park system, our great trail system, and all of that. And the other thing I would say is we're all becoming what they're calling the sharing economy.
Right.
The Uber and the Lyft and
Uber.
And Airbnb and, you know, borrowed tools and, right. And, you know, we just aren't so much into ownership as perhaps the generation before us. I think I agree with John that it's not only the millennials and those other young people, but the boomers in particular are interested in that as well.
And I definitely want to get into how the sharing economy and these innovative ways in getting around, be it Uber or Car2Go or things like that, is going to change things without it having to be policy necessarily. So, take our first question here.
Good evening, thanks for being here. My question is about the gas tax, the 6.5%. Number $6 billion represents over $1,000 per person in Minnesota over that period. $6 billion for 5.5 million people, that's where that number's coming from. So my question would be, from a background in economics where my degree is in, if I move around and it costs me more to move around, the same would be true for anything that I buy, bananas, anything that needs to be transported. So can you talk about the price inflation effect of a gas tax? Because I worked for the Department of Revenue a couple years ago when they had a $2 billion increase in business-to-business taxes, and they projected no inflationary increase for consumer prices. Can you speak to the gas tax and the $6 billion in that effect?
I told you I don't have to get cerebral at all at these things. It's just like, you know, screw it. I don't have to do any homework, basically. All right.
Just a couple of things. Great question. Thank you for bringing it back to arithmetic. You know, in 1990, the state fuel tax was 20 cents. Now it's 28 and a half cents. Had that 20-cent tax been indexed to inflation, we would now have a 51 cents per gallon tax. So, you know, it's not just that cars are getting more fuel efficient, that the kind of the way it's priced has not kept up with general increases costs of maintenance, snowplows, asphalt, road construction generally. I would submit that that $1,000 actually might be a good investment, because the cost that individuals, citizens, and businesses are now incurring, and certainly will incur, if we don't keep up with the system, will be dramatically more. Case in point, it's not just the mayor who drops off his bent wheel, but it's the cost of congestion. We've actually estimated through the Texas Institute of Transportation a freight tax, a congestion on the freight coming through the metro has over $230 million a year. I mentioned that to the CEO of Cargill, and he said, clearly you don't consider agriculture part of Minnesota business, because I can tell you, you are way underestimating the cost of congestion to our goods and services throughout the state. So when we look at fees and services, we have to take a bigger lens to understand what is the cost of a degrading system, and what is the cost of not having the strategic expansion and the choices that citizens want. So I actually think of it less as more of a cost and more of a how do we invest to ensure that we're being efficient and that we are actually saving costs and that we're maintaining prosperity going forward. So I think it's absolutely economics, and I think there's a strong business case for investment for not just our choices for the future, but just dollars and cents about the system we have.
John?
So I'm an engineer by training, so I'm going to try that arithmetic thing.
I'm not an engineer. So.
And I'm not going to do that either.
I'm just going to take it from a different perspective. We know how much our cell phone bills are. I know for my family it's over $200 a month. And if you take the, just let's take the gas tax. Let's say you do drive and you drive 12,000 miles a year and you have a car that's not so fuel efficient, maybe at 20 miles a gallon. That means you're buying about 600 gallons of gas a year, right? 28.5 cents. If you multiply that together, that gets you about, what's my number here? I just had it on my calculator. $171. $171 in gas tax that you pay a year if you're driving that much with that fuel-efficient car. My cell phone bill is less than, or is more than that, on a monthly basis. So if you're talking about the access that you have to go from St. Paul up to Bemidji, up to a little country road in Bemidji, to a lake that you enjoy, you're paying for that access for $171 a year, at least on the state highway system, or at least through the gas tax. There are other funds that pay for that as well, so I don't want to discount those. But just think about, what's that value to you of getting fresh strawberries in the wintertime in Minnesota? What's the ability to get somewhere where you need to go when you need to get there? Is it worth $171 at least in gas taxes that you pay a year? Just a thought.
All right, our next question here.
Hi, I was just wondering if there was any perspective on transit-oriented development to both manage transit as well as potential population and economic growth, particularly in the metro, as we become a less car-dependent society?
Great question. I mean, like, how in the hell do you decide where the... An attendant question is, how do you decide where the light rail lines are going to go? That's the other thing, is that how in the world is that figured out? But her general question first.
Could the person who said that stand up? I love you. Because that's what I do every day, day in and day out. That's what I think about is transit-oriented development. That's what our department does in Community Works for Hennepin County.
She thought you were really funny, too, by the way. So, you know, that's cool. But she's not a mathematician. All right. Anyway, go ahead, John.
So within Hennepin County, we have, and I'll get a little wonkish for a second here, just to say how we pay for transit, particularly for our light rail lines, because we hadn't touched on that. It's a bit of a convoluted system, just as the highway system and the county road system is funded. Transit, particularly the light rail system that I think you've probably either used or have heard about in the news with Southwest and Botno and Central Corridor and such, it's paid for 50% if the federal government stays solvent, 50% by federal transit funds, 30% by this organization called the County's Transit Improvement Board, which are five counties that have banded together to self-impose a sales tax that's dedicated to transit. And then it's 10% by the state, which it's 10%, but it's an important 10%.
You're welcome.
We haven't seen the money yet for Southwest, so we'll wait for that one. And then 10% from the county that the light rail line is in. So, for example, with Southwest, it would be 100% in Hennepin County, so that 10% is going to come from Hennepin County residents through our Hennepin County Regional Railroad Authority. So that's just a quick tutorial on how at least the transit lines, the transitways, fixed rail is paid for. That's not the buses. So the question then is, if we're making these big investments, Southwest is estimated to be $1.67 billion, Botno is another billion-dollar project. If we're investing that much money, Central was another $1 billion, Hiawatha, granted it was 10 years ago, I think it was in the 650 range or thereabouts. So these are huge investments that we're making in the region. How do we make those infrastructure investments turn into how we want to live? When it comes down to it, it's about quality of life. It's about giving people choices. And if we don't create the density around those transit stations through transit-oriented development, those lines aren't going to be successful. And you know what? Our economy isn't going to be successful because we're not going to be as efficient in how we move people around to get to their jobs, to get to the doctor, to get to the grocery store.
I've never done this before, but I have this inclination. Does anybody want to ask like a rabble-rousing question at this point? Like, does anybody want to like throw a bomb in the middle of this conversation? All right, yeah, somebody wants to. I'll come back to you in a second. No, you don't get to hold the mic, though. Sorry.
Okay, so I'll get to a question, but first I'd like to say, appropriating George H.W. Bush, I would love to see Charlie get up to a microphone someday and say, "Read my lips. No new roads."
The no road pledge.
Wow. Okay, yeah.
And what I mean by that basically is I think that if you're going to go to the taxpayers and ask for more money, more gas tax, which I think a lot of people do support, and I support, absolutely, I think there needs to be some kind of guarantee that we're going to be spending it in the right way. There's been a lot of criticism that we're way overly focused on new construction. You look at new Highway 212s and 610s and Stillwater Bridges and things like that, while urban infrastructure is highly bottlenecked, if not falling into a river. So there's some criticism on that end, I guess. How would you respond to that? How, with this gas tax increase, how do you plan for... How do you guarantee that existing infrastructure is going to be maintained before we are expanding the road system out beyond what we already have?
Won't you just take his word for it?
That's a great comment, question, and I don't take pledges, although I have heard that before. But I have to tell you, idea that we actually have to invest in the system we have first, fix it first, maintain the system we have. Absolutely, and out of that $6 billion gap, easily $4 billion of it is to modernize what system we have now, just to keep it in good or better shape, and actually modernize it. When we rebuilt our I-35E just right here going north, half of that is done. It's in pretty good shape. It's in better shape. than it was. It's actually better than it was in the 60s when it was built. It's modernized. But we didn't add a lot of new capacity. Well, we did. We added a MinPass lane. We'll actually have a transit corridor. So roads and transit work very, very much hand in hand. So when we add new capacity in the metro area, we actually don't add just another general purpose lane generally. We almost always add a transit lane that has that MinPass capability of adding pricing so individual cars can go, but they'll pay their way. So I actually think the $2 billion is for some expansion, but it has to be strategic expansion. And I tell you what, I've been in every part of the state. Everybody has a story about an additional lane, a passing lane, some interchange. But our feeling is we will not be able to build our way like we did in the 60s and the 70s. That's quite honestly true. We have to be strategic about it, but it has to be part of a puzzle that incorporates transit, incorporates bike lanes, incorporates main streets, pedestrian space, so it adds to how we think of transportation going forward, just not big, more general lanes. So in general and philosophy, I agree with you.
Question from Twitter, who pays for bike infrastructure? How does that paid for? It's a percentage of the roads and bridges?
You know, here's a funny little known fact is that there's nothing in the Constitution that says that state roads can't accommodate bikes in certain places. But having said that, there are dedicated funds for safe routes to schools, for some bike lanes, from DNR trails. A lot of the bike funding comes from counties like Hennepin, or the city of St. Paul has a plan now. It's a debate, but it has a plan. So it's a real mix of funding, but it's not any one source, and it's not. There's no dedicated funds like there is for the highway funds. However, some of the highway funds can be spent on bike capacity. The former Congressman Obistar, before he died, took me aside, and he said, you know, on some of these roads, like on the way to Bemidji, he said it's really important to have shoulders that accommodate snow, because that's really safe, to have shoulders that accommodate snow storage. And then he whispers over to me and he says, and it makes great bike lanes too, so keep that in mind.
But I mean, where does the actual political muscle come for that? You know, how do we, if people really want bike lanes, if the public, well, certainly this room wants bike lanes, but how do we know that and I'm seriously. And I read all the time, this is where people want this. People want trains. They want bike lanes and whatnot. That, I mean, can we take that for granted now? That do we know that? And where do we? It sort of seems like anecdotally that's the case with the younger generation.
I'm just going to briefly answer that in Bemidji. And, you know, all of you folks are from communities in this metro area, you know, whether that's Burnsville or Shoreview or wherever you're from. It could be St. Paul, it could be somewhere else. But your community is going to be where you want to focus, I think, because here's what's happened in Bemidji. We had a lot of folks that said, we need to start thinking about having a more active transportation system. And part of the ways we did that was to get funding from Blue Cross Blue Shield and the Center for Prevention, which was the tobacco funding. And so we got grants over 5 years' time to invest in strategies for active living, and part of that was programming, but part of that also was just to build that advocacy for multimodal transportation. And so all of a sudden our city council started to talk about having sidewalks in all subdivisions, and so we change our zoning ordinance. We start to talk about if we're going to have a bike lane on one of our streets that we're going to redo. We talk about having a grade separated trail because, you know, let's narrow that street up. It's way too wide. That right away makes everybody go too fast. How about if we take some of that and make this grade separated trail? And so your community can start investing in those things, and then you leverage those other dollars, whether that's DNR grants or DOT, what we used to call the granting program that the TPAC, or what do you call that? ATP or something?
ATP,
yeah,
right.
That's it. So you start to build that advocacy group in your community, and you just go to your city engineers and your planners and your council members, and you advocate on behalf of that, and you build that support. And Complete Streets is another place that you could go, although you don't have to have a Complete Streets ordinance in order to really invest in multimodal transportation.
Giving us a lot of things to Google, make notes of, and to Google when this is over here. All right, now, I'm getting kind of a cue here of who I want to go to. So in the red cap in the front, I see you. I'm going to get
She's
you in a
been
moment.
Very patient.
I know, and with tired arm, I'm sure, up there. And also right in here, I see you. I'm going to go to this person for our next question.
I run an adult day center in St. Paul, and so all of the people that come there come from out in the community. It's in like a larger assisted living facility type thing. But out of the 45 clients that come there, only 3 of them live on site. So all of them are transported to and from the day center, either by their family or by Metro Mobility. And so, I mean, of course, I'm talking about community engagement. It's amazing to see how these people flourish when they're not totally sedentary inside their homes. But the question is, the sort of transportation that's available to them, when it works, it's great. When it doesn't, it's nightmarish. I had a call at 7 p.m. once from a driver from Metro Mobility saying, I have this guy and he seems kind of confused. He won't sit down. Well, he has stage 5 dementia and he's deaf. So none of that is translated. So, you know, I could have like a million stories like that. But my question is, you know, how do you see transportation for the elderly? And not only the elderly, but handicapped people in general, how do you see that progressing in the future?
Thank you for asking that, by the way, because seriously, somebody told me there might be like a retirement boom coming. So that's maybe an important thing to talk about. Yeah.
So that is a huge, huge dilemma that we're gonna that we already are facing, but that is a tsunami. I mean, people call it the gray tsunami. One of the things, when I served on the Met Council and on the Transportation Committee, that we really struggled with is Metro Mobility. Because Metro Mobility, the demand for it is outpacing the ability to keep up with the costs. Because every Metro Mobility trip costs a lot more than we get back from the actual fares, or the Met Council gets back from the fares. And what it does is, it's not like if you get volume that you make it up, because actually the more volume they have, the more in the hole you get, because you subsidize it by such a wide margin. And at the same time, it's not only federally mandated, but it's a moral responsibility for us to take care of all folks and to provide them with opportunities for health and other things. And so it is a huge problem. I don't have a good answer to it. What I do think about, though, is what's coming in the future, with whether it's car sharing or other services, that we need to think about how do we plug into those other services, and that maybe Metro Mobility is one choice that people have, but maybe it's the voucher for that car sharing program, or maybe there's another way that we can do it, because Metro Mobility as it currently is structured is not sustainable.
And the reality is, mainstream transit, even Metro Transit here in this area and greater Minnesota around the entire state, only touches, 15% of the population. So as we build out the transit system, which is a large reason we're actually talking about increased funding, increased capacity for transit, it allows more boomers and others to be more in mainstream vehicles by having greater density of living and building along corridors. Is part of the benefit of that is that it helps those of us who are getting older.
I mean, I'll just share on Greater Minnesota Transit, which Charlie mentioned, gets funding from MnDOT and the gas tax, or no, the license tabs?
Some motor vehicle sales tax and general fund and federal funding.
So in any case, in Bemidji, we have Paul Bunyan Transit. Of course, I forgot to mention we're the home of Paul and Babe, in case you forgot that, but I have to be sure to say that. But Paul Bunyan Transit is dial-a-ride, so we don't have a fixed route system, and a lot of people would like to have a fixed route system so that you can get from downtown up to the hospital or out to the mall and that, you know, the commercial strip and to the university and back again. You know, it seems pretty easy, but apparently the way their funding is structured, we're not allowed to have a fixed route system, and so that's a frustration for us. But when you talk about not building new roads, let's invest in other kinds of transportation. We'd like to have a four-lane highway that goes to Bemidji. Some people call that the Paul Bunyan Expressway, and personally, I'd rather have high-speed rail that goes back and forth. Yeah.
You have a great inner-city bus service that comes up to Bemidji.
Oh, Jefferson Lines serves Bemidji, just in case you didn't know. Plus, we have a great airport. I have to say that our airport relies on federal and state DOT funds as well. And believe it or not, Bemidji's airport is the fourth busiest airport in the state of Minnesota. Of course, Minneapolis-St. Paul is number one. Number two is Rochester, because they have the Mayo Clinic, and everybody has to go in and out of there from all over the world. And number three is Duluth. Number four is Bemidji, because we have two Delta planes that fly in and out of Bemidji every day, because, you know, you'd love to come to Bemidji, but sometimes you have to get the hell out of there.
Okay. All right. We really need to talk about bikes, and we just haven't talked about it enough. Now, I may need to skip over some people that I had in my mental queue, because I really need to take some burning bike questions. But I will take you first, because I promised you, so.
Okay, thanks. Mine isn't a biking question. I work for St. Stephen's Human Services. It's a nationally leading agency that works with people who are experiencing homelessness. And bus tokens are worth their weight in gold. We pass them out a bunch of times a day to a lot of different people trying to get between shelters, trying to get to the Opportunity Center. But a huge demographic that we're working with are working families. We're seeing an incredible increase in people, in a demographic of people who have children, people who are married and staying with their spouse who have children, people who are young mothers. And what I kind of want to know is, what are plans for increased public transportation, and how do we keep it affordable? Because a lot of people that we work with are unable to get to work every single day because they just don't have those $2 on them. And I'm just kind of wondering, we're seeing this becoming more and more of a problem where I'm working. But when we talk about the light rail coming into North Minneapolis and not the best area that it could be in, I'm just wondering, is the demographic of people experiencing poverty and experiencing homelessness, is that a priority? And if it's not, how do we make it a priority?
Talk to your legislators.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You know, I sit on a multi-agency commission of ending homelessness with Kathy Tenbrook, who used to be in the metro area. And you worked for, you know, and I'm actually impressed. It's really led by Human Services and the Housing Department, but we recognize that if we're going to end homelessness in the state of Minnesota, that there's a huge transportation component. And it is primarily affordable transit. We recognize that access to jobs and access to school, having a car, is incredibly expensive. It's not just the ownership of the car. It's not, and certainly it isn't the gas tax. It's the insurance. It's the parking. It's the repairs, and it's a real barrier. And I think that that is one of the reasons that people are driven into homelessness. And we recognize that building out the transit system is a system. It's not a light rail line. It's not just have to live along the blue line or the green line. It is being on a bus route, having access to a bus route that can connect to the system efficiently. And that's the problem, is you can't really evaluate it by a road or a bus line or a light rail line. It is how it all works together so that you can live in Frogtown and get to that job and Eden Prairie. I mean, that's the benefit of the Southwest Line, is it actually has access to jobs and not have that cost. And that's probably the simplest answer.
Yeah, John.
Well, want to also recognize that one of our former commissioners in Hennepin County is now at St. Stephen's. So you got a good one. Yeah. She is phenomenal. She is very committed and dedicated to the cause. I have a personal story to share on this one. My older brother, has a developmental disability and lives in a group home near the state fairgrounds. And we fought darn hard to get him in that group home because there was transit access there. So he could get to, he doesn't have a car, he doesn't drive, he's on his bike, and he has his bus pass. And so I very much understand how important that is. Now the challenge though is, and this comes from, you know, from when it comes down to it, it's money, because someone's, again, it gets back to who pays for it. I think that we need to remember that as we build out these billion-dollar light rail lines in this spine of a system, that really the circulation system, the veins that feeds all of these muscles within the region is the bus line. The bus is really as not, they're not sexy, they're not fancy, but they're the workhorse. There's where people are going to get access to transit. And we can't let our investments in light rail transit eat away or undermine the necessary improvements that we need to make in the bus system. And actually, one big win recently, and kudos to our Metro Transit Met Council colleagues, is that they received a federal grant to enhance bus stations, particularly in North Minneapolis. And that, I, Bruce, help
sorry, that
me
was
with
me.
The number. Help me with the number there. Was it some 10? 3 million. 3 million, sorry. About 3 million to make a number of improvements in transit stops, particularly in the North Metro, in North Minneapolis. I don't know the five route as well as maybe Bruce does, or maybe you do, but Bruce, right back there, like two tables behind you, could answer your question. Bruce Howard, by the way, communications director for Metro Transit.
Thanks for coming. All right, our next question.
Okay, I'm a cyclist. We've been around long before automobiles. Why are we still treated as third class in the transportation infrastructure? Over 100 years now, we get nothing. We got enforcement that's lax. If I get hit by an automobile or get killed by an automobile, nothing happens. Oh, he got hit. Was he wearing a helmet? No. Oh, well, that was his fault. Come on, get with the program. We've been here a lot longer than automobiles, and we were treated as third-class citizens.
What would you like to see that translated as, though? Like, getting with the program would mean what?
Well, okay, you talked earlier about your... about the fuel tax. The fuel tax needs to go up so some of that money can come back to us. Remember, all the roads were first built for who? Cyclists. Is this true? Everybody agree with me on this? Yeah, see? You got it. You got it.
Horses.
Yeah.
Oxen.
Okay. MnDOT has a lot of work to do.
Charlie says, don't forget about horses, but yes.
Well, yeah, of course they were developed for horses, but who came next? Us. Us. Not automobiles. Automobiles came along later. No. Go anywhere else in the world.
Motor coaches came right before.
Okay, Charlie, enough from you.
Okay, trains. All right, you want me to break it down? Pedestrians,
no.
Horses, trains, bikes, automobiles, airplanes, blah, blah, blah. Come on, we got to look at the reality here.
I actually agree with you. We have a long way to go, both in terms of government policy, but more importantly, kind of culturally. I was actually struck by taking a kind of a bike ride tour of Portland with Maya Burke. She's written a lot of the books about biking and urban development and how you make cities bike friendly. And what struck me, it was about 4 years ago, is that a lot of the car traffic, I could just sense, was much more in tune that bikes are just equal partners on the road. And I have to say that even though we probably even have more trails, we're in a state of evolution, and I think we're making progress. I think more bikes on the road, more bike trails, more conversation about it, that we as a metropolitan area are evolving. And I've called it a revolution earlier, but it is evolution. I think that as more people use this system, we are going to be kind of more conscious in our urban design. I know Hennepin County's got a great new project really kind of separating bikes, but the reality is I think we have to give ourselves credit that we've made great progress. We have a lot farther to go in terms of how we share roads and how we understand that bikes are not the nuisance but just part of the system. So I agree with you, but I think we're making progress.
There's a word that I'm surprised hasn't come out yet in this conversation, And I think that it was a dirty D word before, but in the 2010s, in right now, it's becoming less of one. And the word is density. Without density, transit, bike mobility, pedestrian mobility, it really falls flat. It just doesn't work as effectively or cost-effectively or efficiently.
What you mean is people living in more concentrated areas.
That's a very good definition. Who is that?
That was your host. I was just making sure we were, you know, talking. We were all understanding what you meant by that. Okay.
So that is how we choose to live. If we decide that we can live closer together and use transit and use services in a more sharing economy, then we can have more of this type of stuff. But until we make some different choices in how we want to live, how we want to get around is a function of how we live. It doesn't work the other way, by the way.
It would seem that if the surveys, the studies and whatnot are telling the truth, then younger people want to live in more metropolitan areas. They want to be able to bike. They want to be able to walk. And this goes back to what I was asking earlier, which is that going to drive policy? Because the power of the vote is going to then dictate what happens in communities.
You know, that's a great call to action for this room, because policy follows citizens' voices. But I actually think change happens when you have a confluence of smart arithmetic, policy, and cultural trends. This is where people are wanting to live. This is where we vote. The economy kind of votes with our feet and our bikes and our way of living. So policy will catch up, but it will take time unless we bring voices to it. So that's kind of my plea. And
the thing about that is that it brings me back to what exactly is in the $600 billion that, you know, supposedly is being asked for transportation, for monies for transportation. I mean, is that's not bike trails we're talking about. What is that? Is it road repair? Bridge repair?
Is it six? Well, there's 600. Did you say 600?
I don't know what the figure is, because it's a number and I don't do numbers. Whatever it was, that is the massive amount of money that the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce essentially said, you've got to be kidding. No, we're not going to go for a tax, a tax hike that is what you're asking for.
Well, you know, this Transportation Finance Advisory Committee that I sat on as a simple bus guy 3 years ago actually identified $50 billion over 20 years. And it was all modes. It was bike trails. It was local roads. It was the airport improvements. It is trains. And are we going to be able to raise $50 billion more over 20 years? You know, huge number. But if you look at the GDP, if you look at where incomes are generally in this robust economy, you know, we're doing well in Minnesota in terms of our both outstate and in the metro area. The reality is $6 billion is just the state highway system, state bridges and roads. It does not count local roads in Hennepin County and Bemidji and throughout St. Paul and every other town. I mean, it is a big number, but if you break it down to one beer a month, you know, it's not too
crazy.
Sure,
right. John?
I don't dispute, and I actually very much support the fact that we need more resources for transportation, but I think we have to think about it in a different way. And I actually brought a prop here today.
I was wondering when you were going to get to that.
So, how many people have one of these around anymore?
It's a dictionary, if you can't see what it is, by the way.
I see some hands. How many actually? How many people actually have it at their desk and use it? No, an app on your phone does not count. That's
the point. Why would you do that? Why wouldn't you just look it up on your phone? Anyway, your point being.
That's right. Oh, yeah. So I went and searched for this today in my office. We have about 50 people, and I found one person who had it on their desk, and it was only because it was given to him by his mother when he went to college. And it's a sentimental kind of paperweight. But you know what? No one uses this stuff anymore. It's changed. 20 years ago, this is what you had. But now you've got it on your phone. You've got an app. You don't even have to have an app. You can just Google it, and it'll tell you what the word spelling is and the definition. Or if you play Words with Friends, you can use the little cheat.
So spending money in sensible ways is what we're talking about.
Yes. So getting back to that, I really think that our transportation system is going to go the way of the dictionary and how we think about using it and funding it. And here's the hook, is that if you think about the sharing economy, that's one thing. But there's another confluence of things that's going to come from the other direction, which is automated vehicles.
Guy wanted to talk about that, actually.
What happens when you have a vehicle that can basically be autonomous and drive itself, and you know what? You don't have to own it. I can pay for a part of that vehicle. I can lease it. I can subscribe to it and have it come when I need it to. I won't need a parking garage anymore. I won't need necessarily to pay for it to park because it's going to continue to deliver me and go somewhere else. It could actually be our transit. If it, you know, think of a 6-passenger car or a 15-passenger van that can drive itself around and pick a bunch of people up and drop people off. How we define our system and how we move around is going to be much different in 20, 30, 40 years.
So we won't potentially own these cars. Socialism. Okay, so our next question here.
Private clubs.
I want to touch on the connected vehicle. The whole issue, I just came from Washington yesterday, the Transportation Research Board. The technology is there, the car companies are getting ready, and the reality is it is actually benefits both for citizens and all of us who are using it, but for the road companies. Where's the back to the no new lane guy? There you are. When we have connected vehicles, and by the way, vehicle technology is changing, those of you who noticed all the gizmos, well, you know, when you have cars going at a constant rate of speed and we're driving more capacity and safety, when these cars are actually talking to each other, it's not just autonomous. They actually talk to the road and they talk to each other. And when you take a car and it actually predicts the traffic signals for the entire trip, and so you're never actually stopping. It's all kind of coordinated. I mean, this sounds kind of like space age. It is not so space age. I'm actually struck by the fact that this technology is changing. However, John, this doesn't come for free. You know, people pay for their iPhones, and they actually pay quite a bit. And it's more about software. It's more about thinking about building these big 20, 30-year systems that have the flexibility to be able to incorporate some of the technology improvements that we're all going to see in the next 10 years.
I'm going to wrap it up here in just a second. So I'm going to take probably two more questions. This guy's been waiting very patiently.
We've been talking a lot about strategically kind of finding a way to spend funds well, and I am taking this opportunity to kind of be the voice of my community, and I realize it won't affect all of you, so I'll ask a bigger general question and then my real question. But first of all, kind of folks like you that are in the, you know, kind of transportation role, what effect do you guys have when there's a politically persnickety kind of transportation issue? And then more specifically, what the heck happened to the streetcars that were supposed to tear down that goddamn Kmart on Nicollet?
The Kmart! I love it. I can't believe somebody asked about the Kmart. Yeah, anyway, go ahead.
Ask Minneapolis that. The city is leading up the streetcar conversation, and more power to them. I think that the city is very engaged in that as an economic development tool, as well as a way to move people around. And so it's going to be a tough one because it all comes down to who pays and how is it going to get paid for, and is there going to be, how do you prioritize between the various investments that we have within the region?
And there's a study here in St. Paul along 7th, so you know it's not just Minneapolis. There's streetcar studies.
All right, I hate to do it, our last question, because there's so many people, so many fabulous questions. You people want to go for, can you guys go for 5 more minutes? Can you go for 5, 10?
Yeah,
can we do that?
Sure.
All right, I'll take a couple more after this. Okay, I'll take a couple more.
Thank you for being here. You talked earlier about aging, and not everybody might need metro mobility. People won't be able to drive. They maybe can't walk so easily, so how will transit work for that? The other question is, John talked about density. So how do we work with housing, transit, jobs together to make a more livable community?
I guess I'll take that one since I heard my name. So how we do that is particularly around our light rail stations that are currently existing, and we're seeing it happen. There is density that's being attracted to those station areas. We're also seeing it, early signs of it, along the Southwest line, even though it's not, you know, it's not a done deal. There's still a lot of conversations to be had there. But developers are seeing those as opportunities to do higher density development. And I'll defer to my colleagues at the city level because, you know, we have an interesting way of organizing ourselves within the United States. You know, you've got the role of the federal government, the state government, the county government, and the cities. The cities are the primary authority for land use. They make those decisions of how much density there is, although we as a region are investing in this light rail system. So it's really the cities that are the key players in how we develop around those transit stations, and we at the county are working partnership with them to figure out how do we make that work? How do we make it successful for them, and how can they adopt a vision for higher density and for mixed-use development around our various station areas? We are doing station area planning for, not only did we do it on Central Corridor, but also we're doing it ahead of schedule for Southwest and for Botno lines.
So, do you guys want a beer or something? You guys like, since we're going over here and you're like trapped up there, does anybody want a drink up there?
Sure.
Rita wants something. What?
Lonely.
So
blonde.
Go up and ask Rita what she wants. Somebody ask Rita what she wants, and please, it's on me. Okay.
I'll have the Duchette Butte Porter.
All right.
Maybe just on the stage.
But anyway, go ahead, yeah, Rita.
I'm just going to comment a bit on what John said in response to that question as far as the city's having control. And that is true even in small communities like Bemidji. We are thinking about how can we be a sustainable city into the future. And part of that is becoming more compact. And we're a pretty walkable, compact city, which is the reason that Nice Ride this year decided to put their bikes up there. They kind of gave the litmus test. Just to tell you, if you haven't been to Bemidji, they're orange, not green, so that's kind of fun. But the litmus test was, could you come to Bemidji, park your car, and get around town and have fun? And they found out, you know what, you could for a whole weekend do a lot of fun things. It's very compact, walkable. We have side streets and actually through streets that are not high traffic, and so they're safe, and there's a lot of opportunity to connect. And I talked to Tony Desnick this morning, and he owns Nice Ride, and talked about some of the changes, what they learned the first year, what they're going to change. A lot of great ideas. But our land use code, our planning, is not only related to streets and how do we get around, but also to all of our utilities. If you're going to have 2-acre lots, you aren't going to be able to afford to put utilities out to them, and the cost of the street is going to be more. And I think we should be thinking from a point of abundance rather than a place of scarcity, because there's abundance in our world. We know that there's enough money to do the things that people want to do. I heard on NPR this morning about the coat drive that one of the schools here in the community needed a coat drive, and they just came from
twice
everywhere.
As many coats as they
there's abundance out there. We just have to be thinking about how do we figure out how to tell our policymakers what we want and convince them that this is really important for our future.
All right, next question. This guy has been waiting very patiently here.
Thank you. Hi. Just a quick comment about the automated vehicles. We already have automatic vehicles. They're called buses and trains, and that keeps the cars off the road. But my favorite question tonight was to Charlie when he asked, who gets to decide? Charlie said, we do. And by we do, that means us. We get to vote. We need to get out to the polling place. On the November elections, we need to vote the people in that give us what we need for transit and biking. We also need to listen to it sounds kind of hokey, but the earth is telling us what to do. The earth is telling us that the climate is changing and that we have to quit burning fossil fuels. We have to listen to those signals and pay attention to them now so that we can make change to prevent climate change. So if you guys can talk about climate change and what we can do to reverse that.
Okay, so you want to...
You know,
you really want to drink now, right? I mean, two or three.
Yeah, forget the beer. I like a scotch.
Okay. Because we're going to be here for a while.
Yeah, settle in. I have a great honor being on the Environmental Quality Board, and we've made climate change one of the issues to actually study. And if you think about, now Mike Nobles will have the right figure, but you know, a third of the carbon coming from the transportation sector, we have a stake in the long-term sustainability of our planet. And you know, is a gas tax a carbon tax? I don't know. That's a great question. I'm not sure we politically have that kind of mandate, but I think that the idea of transit and the way people want to live is changing, and the more your voice is heard and others, that'll make that difference. So thank you.
I think you're right when you say you need to get out and vote and you need to be an advocate, and all of you here, I'm sure, are that. You know, in Bemidji, it's surprising. It's somewhat of a progressive community in greater Minnesota. You know what happened in the elections this past year. The House turned over to the Republicans because of voters in greater Minnesota, but not in Bemidji. They elected a progressive mayor. They elected... we have a state rep who's a Democrat, and we have a state senator who's a Democrat. Partly because there's a university there, and that brings a lot of energy and a little bit different kind of atmosphere to our community. I just want to say a shout out to Carrie Cooper, who is a Bemidji State grad. Any other Bemidji State grads in the room, raise your hand. But I just want to say, as far as the climate, we're a Green Step city. We have a guaranteed savings program with Honeywell right now in our community, and we're finding ways to reduce our energy footprint for the city itself. We haven't gone to like propane fuel for our cars and our fleet and our police. But one thing that's happening that you might be surprised about is we're in the midst of a comprehensive planning process. We're talking about tiny house subdivisions. Now, who would have thunk it in greater Minnesota that we'd have a tiny house subdivision? But I'm looking that we'll probably have some of those because there's really a demand. People are asking for it, and we're trying to respond to that.
I think just as important as going out to the polls and voting and making sure your voices are heard at the Capitol and at city halls is also how you vote with your dollars. That's just as powerful of a statement of how you spend your money, how you decide where you live, how you decide where you want or how you want to get around. Those matter. Uber has a market cap of $40 billion right now. Higher than Delta Airlines, higher than Best Buy. If you decide that car sharing is the way to go, and I'm not advocating for Uber because goodness knows the press they've been getting lately has not been that great. You know, maybe it's Lyft, maybe it's somebody else. But if you believe that that's the way of the future and that's how you want to live and that's how you want to spend your money, that's what's going to get the attention. And so I would say that you have more power than you really think you do.
And those are market-based solutions, which a lot of people can get behind because they're not tax revenue-based. Okay, so next question.
Hey, Commissioner Zelli, I'm going to be in a meeting with you at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning, so be careful on those pints, okay?
I just want to... thanks for the reminder. Yeah.
I've been in local government for 35 years, and this is actually a question for the mayor. Mayor, so many times at council meetings... people don't know really how to engage and get their voices heard and really to have their points made. Can you just talk about the impact that you can have on transportation issues, whether it's road quality or bike trails? A lot of times people just don't know how to engage.
Thanks for that question. I think it's really important to understand that there's sort of strength in numbers. So the more of you together, that makes a difference. But having your information clear, well presented, ready to go, and also being not aggressive, I guess is the word I would say, you know, not accusatory to council members and city councils have a lot of challenges. I see Kevin Frizzell here from the League of Minnesota Cities, another friend of mine who came out to say hi, and he knows as well as I do that. And are you a mayor or a council member? City manager, yeah. That sometimes when advocates come, they're angry, and that doesn't really sit well with elected officials. It's a whole lot better to come and want to have a discussion and inform, and I think it helps to have patience because cities notoriously move slowly. Things happen slowly in government. But definitely understanding your issue, be ready to answer questions, and I think there's strength in numbers. Bring some friends with you.
Next question back here.
I want to talk about the light rail corridor and how the majority of the metro area wants that, and a small minority in Kenilworth has blocked that because they have the political power and the wealth to do such a thing, and how we can, as a majority, do something about that, because that's something we want. We want to look for the future. We want to make that happen. How can we do that?
First of all, how do we know that the majority wants it? And how, I mean, quite literally, how do you determine? Well, no. How is a decision made that we know that people want light rail?
I'll take the last question, and I'm going to totally punt on the first question because I could lose my job on that one.
I'll answer it.
I'll let Charlie answer because I think you live over in that corridor as well, so he knows.
I just lose friends, not my job.
Okay. So to the latter question is, how do we know people want it? The evidence is right in front of us. If you look on 6 or on Cedar, wherever the central corridor is a block away from here, it hit 40,000. What is that right? 40,000 riders per day. That was an estimate that wasn't supposed to happen until 2025 or 2030. It opened up, and 3 months later, it was hitting its ridership targets for 15 years from now.
And it's sustained?
And that's sustainable, yes. I think the numbers are there. I think we see it. I think that Southwest and Botno building on that system is going to build more success. It's one of those economies of scale. The more and more extensive system you have, the more cost-effective you have, and also the more people want to ride it because they can actually get to more places.
Does anybody want to be a counterpoint on that, by the way? Because I just want to... What's that? Eden Prairie sucks, is what we got from over there. No.
I have a lot of good friends at Eden
Prairie. How about a real counterpoint? Really? Not in this crowd? Okay, next question here.
So to kind of bring it back to the idea of funding earlier, we were talking about the gas tax. I read an article in the Star Tribune within the last week or two that basically referenced that Minnesota has the fifth largest highway system in the country. Yet, just a quick Google search said we have the 21st largest population in the country. So part of my question is the idea of how much are we funding? Why are we funding such a large system for the state when it seems like, just from around numbers, that maybe it's not necessary? So kind of two parts to it. Can we divert some of this money that we're thinking using the gas tax? We're thinking $6 billion or so. Can we divert that to other sources, bike, transit, buses, whatever we think would be best used? Partially also, can we maybe just not rebuild some of these things? We're saying we're going to spend $6 billion to rebuild this system. Maybe some of this system doesn't need to be rebuilt.
Yeah. Are there some times when we just wouldn't rebuild a road? Maybe not a dangerous bridge, but go ahead, yeah.
Well, you know, first on this point, that's maybe measured by, there's ways to measure the system. Is it by centerline, you know, miles? In other words, just the miles of roads. Is it by lane miles? It's a complicated system. We do have a robust statewide highway system because we're largely an agricultural state. That was the biggest part of our economy, was getting, you know, grain to market. The reality is we have different volumes on each one of those roads. So the real question is, you know, the interstate carries just the highest amount of volume. Then you have major state arteries. Just the state system, which is 12,000 miles. I probably got that wrong. Somebody's going to correct me. Yeah, oh, I'm right. Oh, God, amazing. But that carries more than 50%, maybe 60% of the traffic. So actually, a lot of the cost of maintaining and improving a system isn't on that entire system. The lower volume roads don't take quite as much maintenance costs. However, we're in a really tough climate. We're in the ninth
most difficult climate for roads, which I actually find kind of surprising because I want to know, you know, who's 1 through 8. I don't, you know, I mean, aren't we the worst? But the fact is, as we look toward rationalizing a system, we do, and we should, we're studying how do we, what they call turn back. The state roads are turned back to counties. So I say, John, you take this road. Well, he says, well, if we county are going to take this road, then we, state of Minnesota, will fix that road up and make it in pretty good shape. And then the county says to the town, you know what, we don't want this. We'll give it back to the town. And the town, but then they have to kind of repair it and put it in good shape. And then the town brings it to the private farmer or whoever it is, and then it turns into a gravel road. That is a slow process. It does happen. But it is not one where you can kind of wave a magic wand and say, let's just cut, you know, thousands of miles out. But it is happening. We're studying it. We're finding ways of where's the best investment for what is needed. And so it's not just, not all roads are the same, I guess I'm willing to say.
I want to just say that I know the folks in this room are very focused on the metro. And you're wondering, you know, why do we have the fifth largest transportation system or road system in? Because our state is so big, and it's a long ways from here to there. You know, it takes me 4 hours to drive from Bemidji to St. Paul. And our roads up there are really important for a number of reasons. The Bemidji School District, for example, is geographically as large as the state of Rhode Island. So there's a lot of roads that buses have to travel on. We also have timber production up in our neck of the woods that's really important for our country and our state. It's one of the top producers of economic drivers in our state. We cut the timber, and often, the product from that comes down and there's value added. Senator Bach likes to say that. And we, you know, the Northland makes the timber. The metro area adds value to it, makes it into one thing or another, cardboard boxes or paper or whatever. And so in order to get those products to market, that's really important. Charlie talked about the ag sector, but there's other sectors of manufacturing in greater Minnesota that are important to have that road system as well.
It seems to me that there was a question that got avoided.
What was the question? We forgot.
What are we going to do about getting light rail? How can we go around that?
The Kenilworth corridor issue never got answered.
I'm back to my
neighbor. Because, John, you didn't want to answer it. So does anybody else want to answer it?
I'll answer it. I think that it is really a key part of the entire transit build-out. And there is a neighborhood. And, here was this freight rail line, which was converted into a bike trail. And, my goodness, within 10 or 15 years, it is the most wonderful cedar bike trail. And the people who live along the line that would be disrupted, I have great commiseration for. I mean, there's probably, I think, 6 to 10 houses that are going to be definitely negatively impacted. Having said that, this has not been a secret for 10, 15, 20 years. And there has been, a pretty good mitigation to make this happen. There's a lot of pressure regionally to move forward. Recently in the paper, the governor was quoted as saying, I think the Park Board, which is making plans to do both engineering and a lawsuit to force a deeper tunnel, I don't think that lawsuit would win. And I think the governor is very committed to, not just working with the Park Board, but to express his concern that would block a very important infrastructure project for our state. So don't get the governor wrong. You might be hearing more from him in the days and weeks ahead that this is something that's critical for our regional prosperity. So,
all right, I'm going to take this one, and then what I want is for someone to ask the final, like, burning question that is somewhere between super wonky and you guys suck because bikes rule. So somewhere in between those two poles, but it's a really awesome question. All right, so now no pressure on you either, Terry.
My background is in community organizing, and in my experience, I've seen that a lot of communities of color and low-income communities are really heavily dependent on public transit, walking, biking, alternative forms of transportation. These communities don't have a lot of access to personal vehicles. And I hear what you're saying about density, but I see that sometimes density can promote gentrification and displacement in those communities. And thank you. And I also see that I hear what you're saying about you vote with your dollars, but in low-income communities that could really benefit from some of these structural improvements and access to public transit, they don't have the dollars to vote with. So I'm wondering, is this something that you're thinking about?
Excellent question.
It definitely is at the county level, and not only are we one of the primary funders for build out of the transitway system. So, you know, of the $2.67 billion, the county, Hennepin County for Southwest and Botno, here's the wonky part. I'm trying to get the wonky part in here, Steve, for you. Is gonna pay, or our taxpayers are going to be contributing 25% of that. So about $500 million. From Hennepin County residents, if I did my math right there, which is a large sum. Actually, it's closer to 650 now I do my math. But that's a large sum of money coming from Hennepin County to support this vision for a transitway system. Now, to the question of how do you make this what we call ETOD, Equitable Transit-Oriented Development? How do you achieve that? That's something we're working with many people.
That's like wonk heaven right there.
There it goes.
Anyway, go on, sorry.
My inner wonk came out.
Yeah, right.
And we are working with folks like the McKnight Foundation, the Northside Funders Collaborative, the Central Corridor Funders Collaborative, a lot of different organizations along the Southwest and Botno lines to really figure that out. So it's a work in progress. We've looked at what others are doing throughout the country, whether it's in Denver, Salt Lake City, Dallas, Seattle, Portland, Baltimore, how they've addressed those issues. We are working on it at the county level as well as with our partners at other levels. And there's actually been a great movement here in the Twin Cities of a coalition of nonprofit and advocacy groups that have come together under the umbrella of ISAIAH. That has really, I think, moved the needle on that conversation in the region. And if you're not familiar with them, please, I would encourage you to Google them and to get involved in whatever way you think is appropriate.
All right. I had a feeling. I don't know. I'm just going on a feeling here for this last question.
Thanks. I'm an urban designer, and I spend a lot of time looking at plans, and I see that there's a lot of underutilized public right-of-way that's kind of in the corners of areas, or I'm thinking about MnDOT having a lot of, you know, grassy slopes. I'm wondering, can that land be utilized beneficially for energy collection, carbon sequestration, adding multiple rail lines?
That was a pretty good question. That was pretty good. All right, yeah, all right.
I don't know if you've been following some of the news, but the University of Minnesota Design Center had proposed as a student project putting a lid over 35W and turning it into park space and developable space. And we actually have a proposal in Edina to kind of put a lid over Highway 100. And I really, you know, shock a lot of MnDOT planning staff because I think it's a great idea, you know. And and we should be looking at ways to utilize the assets, the slopes, the right-of-ways. It isn't always just thinking broadly about, and we're experimenting and thinking about and studying lids, which, by the way, actually happened in Duluth. This isn't something that we haven't done before. And we think about how do we use these large footprints in urban areas especially more effectively. And I think as we think about long-term, we have to be creative. And also, we've been approached by solar companies. We even have, you know, goats that want to graze, the butterfly and the bee advocates. You know, we do have a lot of grassy areas that, and let's just start with, we can make them look a lot better too. You know, they're pretty kind of scruffy here on 94. So we have our work cut out for us, but it's very much part of our thinking, not just about
gas tax funding, but more to how do we leverage partnerships, whether it's an arboretum or a corporation, to think about ways to utilize the public space that we have. So we're very much kind of in the percolating the thought, and so as an urban planner, I welcome your input.
So you want to know how MnDOT right-of-ways or cities? I think that in our community, one of the challenges we have is really, you might think we're a town of lakes and pines, but actually keeping our green belt and green corridor undeveloped is difficult. And our urban forestry and our urban forest system is important to us. We have the same kind of challenges with emerald ash borer and elm trees and other kinds of problems there. But our challenge really is to keep our some greenways and green belts that are connected, and in particular along the riparian areas that are along waterways that people want to develop and we're trying to keep from being developed, so that we continue to have habitat for particular birds next to water is important. And one of the things that the city has done is on the south shore of Lake Bemidji, which is about a 6,400-acre lake, we purchased 40 acres there, and we've preserved along that south shore a public right-of-way that is going to be about a mile of public right-of-way, and we have the Paulbunion State Trail runs along there, which is a state trail, and that won't be developed. So everybody who can't live on a lake can go to that spot and be along the lake. And we'll also, we've just received $1.65 million from the Legacy Fund to clean up the lake bed, because there used to be lumber mills there. And what they did was they floated the logs out in the water, and then they ran them up a chain into the sawmill, and a lot of that debris is still in the lake. It's sort of like in the lake bed, it's like 2-3 inch pieces, but on the shore, it's like black coffee grounds. And so we're going to use that clean water money to clean up the lake bed and the lake shore and increase fish habitat and put in some natural plantings, and make that really a public beach that hasn't been used by the public for, I would say, 40 years, because it's been contaminated in that way. So those are some of the things that we're doing to preserve public ways and not necessarily provide solar energy there, but there are discussions about community solar gardens in our community, and I would not be surprised to see that happen in the next 5 years.
You know, a couple of projects that I'm familiar with. One, Metro Transit, when I was on the Met Council, was looking at putting solar panels on top of the Haywood Garage. I'm not sure exactly where that's at. I don't know. Howard, give me a thumbs up, thumbs down.
Not yet.
But there have been discussions there, because it's a large, expansive rooftop. The other example I would encourage you to look at is there's some concepts for in the Prospect Park neighborhood. Anybody, folks familiar with that part? It's close between Minneapolis and St. Paul. The Witch's Tower is probably the most iconic structure there.
The Surly Tap Room is there now.
So there is a partnership called the Prospect Park North Partnership that is working on redeveloping that whole area. Surly is a great addition to that area, but also an innovation park for the university. And there's a concept of how do you do a sustainable street, and the idea is called Green Forth. So you could probably Google Green Forth. There are some proposals that are being presented to the city. It received some livable communities dollars from the Met Council. I think $1.2 million to help get it up and going, and it's going to be seeking some county funding in the future as well. So the idea there is to do a roadway that has permeable surfaces, so that actually the water would drain into the roadway. Also, it would be a complete street. It would be much more pedestrian friendly. It would have light rail going on the corridor, because it's actually there is light rail right there right now. But how do you incorporate all those elements? How do you do district stormwater? How do you also do, it's a really interesting one, district energy in that area? So they're talking about, for those wonky an anaerobic digester.
I've heard that one actually.
Yeah. Those are some of the newest or the most cutting edge technologies for how do you change food waste and other waste into energy. And so those things are being talked about in this community. And if you're not aware of them, definitely Google them or get involved in those efforts.
You know, it just does my heart good that we can have a program like this. We can go over 90 minutes and like nobody has left and everybody is still here and it's like still wrapped and could probably go for another half hour. I'm gonna bring it to a close here, but I just want to thank everyone and I want to, Sean is giving Charlie some scotch.
Oh, that's 7 o'clock meeting.
Not subject to the gift ban, he said. Cheers, Charlie. Everybody, cheers to our guests here tonight. Charlie Zelli, Rita Albrecht, John Doan. Thank you so much for being with us, you guys. I'm so thrilled that this program is 10 years old. It's almost as old as the current is, and we hope to keep it up as long as the current is around. And thank you so much for coming out. And again, heartfelt thanks to the Citizens League for being our partner for 10 years on this wonderful, wonderful program. The support that they give us in every way. They're a wonderful organization. And Sean Kershaw, thank you so much. Cheers to you for heading that organization. And everyone who's involved with the Citizens League, we so enjoy working with you. Thank you for making The Current something that has been on the air for 10 years, and I'm so glad that we could work on a policy and a pint as part of our 10-day celebration of The Current's 10th anniversary. And I want to thank as well my producer, intrepid, hardworking producer Jane Solinger from NPR News, and Ali Lozoff, who always is so critical in making these programs and has been for 10 years going. And the Amsterdam tonight, thank you so much. And thank you to Target Corporation for being a major sponsor. Thank you, everyone. We'll see you on the radio and see you next time for Policy in a Pint. You don't have to leave.